All right, good evening. Welcome. So we're continuing our exploration of the five hindrances that Tuari and I are exploring for the first part of the year. Then we'll switch over to the seven factors of awakening in the latter part, starting in, I believe, in June. And so this month, we're looking at sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor is one of the funnest things to get to say as a Dharma teacher, is sloth and torpor, because we just don't use those words so much. I was looking online about, I guess, the incident's highest use of torpor was in the 1800s, and it's been downhill since then. And one of the hopes I have for this series is for us to start to recognize the hindrances and how pervasive they can really be in our meditation practices, in our spiritual practice, and also in our lives, to start to highlight, in taking these one month at a time, we can start to really sense and get a kind of flesh out the whole expression of these different hindrances and how they affect us, how they cloud our ability to see, how they can be a place to struggle, and also an invitation to work with and to grow into the Dharma is one of their hidden gifts. And tonight, talking about sloth and torpor, is one of the ones we struggle with the most. You know, I think anyone who's meditated for more than a couple of times have experienced this hindrance, you know, its various manifestations. And so we'll explore some of those and how to work with those, both from the more overt, clearly falling asleep modes to the more subtle qualities, the more nuanced qualities of dullness, of fogginess, of lack of clarity. And also start to go into how the hindrance of sloth and torpor is actually a manifestation of one of the primary roots of delusion, and how delusion shows up in sloth and torpor. So in that way, it becomes an invitation to really look at some very deep Dharma instead of something that we have to overcome as beginners. And certainly, I would say, it's not something that just beginners deal with, you know, that people who have been practicing for many years still have these hindrances arise. And even the Buddha had these arise even after his awakening. So it's interesting looking at these two words in sloth and torpor. And I think these are all definitions or translations of a Pali word, Pali concept. And we take an English definition and we have our own way of interpreting that, of understanding that. And just the number of synonyms around these two words kind of reveals something about our cultural inclination toward this. So starting with sloth, so reluctance to work or to make an effort, laziness. So the synonyms are laziness, idleness, slothfulness, inactivity, inertia, sluggishness, apathy, listlessness, passivity, lethargy, torpority, slowness, heaviness, dullness, shiftlessness. So it just kind of goes on and on. Also, sloth is one of the seven major deadly sins. And it's also a slow-moving North American mammal that hangs upside down from the branches of trees. And then torpor even has more synonyms. So it's a state of physical or mental inactivity, lethargy. So synonyms, lethargy, torpidity, sluggishness, inertia, inertness, inactivity, inaction, slowness, lifelessness, dullness, heaviness, listlessness, languor, languidness, stagnation, laziness, idleness, shiftlessness, sloth, slothfulness, apathy, passivity, weariness, tiredness, lassitude, fatigue, sleepiness, drowsiness. So it just goes on and on, you know, so that we definitely have a lot of charge around these two words as in our culture, around the English language. So I think it's important to just check that at the door if we can, when we hear these words sloth and torpor, because it's easy to have this sense of being, being lazy, not being up to the task, that there's something wrong with me. that there's some failing that I have. And if we carry that into our practice, when a sloth and torpor arise, we can quickly tie ourselves into knots. I know I have, in my past, struggled with the fact that I was sleepy and I wanted to be alert. You know, that sense of being a lazy meditator, not being a good meditator because I can't stay awake. You know, and that just added another level of tension. I mean, essentially gave myself a multiple hindrance attack. Right? Yeah, so a sloth and torpor arises, and then I start to be averse to it, and I get tighter around that. And then I get restless and worried because, okay, we got the sit just started, and the retreat just started, and quickly we can add one hindrance upon another. So this is, it's really important to notice, what do we bring to these words? And see, hold that just as a pointing towards something else. Now, how does sloth and torpor show up in our meditation, in our meditative practice? So again, there's this really surprisingly broad spectrum of expressions. There's outright falling asleep. You just can't stay awake. You're nodding. You know, you're snoring. You know, how many people have nodded off in a meditation? Remember the paramis from last year, the truthfulness. You know, it's almost universal that at some point we're going to be nodding and falling asleep. And this isn't so pleasant if we're trying to be awake. We're trying to be alert. There's this struggle with, we just, everything is closing down. I remember just struggling with that often in my early days, of trying to be alert, trying to be present, trying to follow this breath, to be present for this sensation. And my mind is just not cooperating. It's just like a curtain closing around. Everything's is getting dark, and I'm finding myself falling into that abyss of sleepiness. And so it can be very unpleasant when it goes against what you want to happen in that moment. And of course, at nighttime when you want to fall asleep, the sleepiness is absent. One of the analogies that Tuari shared, the beginning of last month around these hindrances, is being in prison. And when you're in prison, it's dark, you have no freedom. And when sleepiness arises like this, especially this overt quality, it does feel like everything is closing in. There's no sense of freedom. You're caught in this confined space. So this is the overt quality of sleepiness. But it becomes more subtle from there. It can start to really be this subtle shift from meditating into daydream, into thoughts. You know, you wake up 5 minutes later and realize, oh, I was back in Hawaii, or I was reliving that summer vacation. So it can be this subtle shift, very, very subtle. And this is tricky because this often is pleasant. Often beginner meditators talk about that kind of drifty mind, that kind of, you know, going in and out. It can feel very pleasant, very relaxing. And it feels, okay, this is meditating because it feels good. So we can't use this quality of Vedana as a good guide, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. Sometimes it can be more subtle than that, than overt thinking. We could be meditating and an image arises, a thought arises, and there's confusion about, okay, was that really happening right now? Because you're kind of almost drifting off into sleep. What am I doing in this moment? And I kind of shift into that dream world. So the sense of drifting, the sense of fogginess. Then it has this more, even more subtle quality of just a level of dullness of attention. The attention isn't so sharp and crisp. It has this quality of fogginess. Sometimes you might be, if you do the noting practice, breathing in and breathing out, when you say that internal phrase, when sloth and torpor are happening, you start to say breathing out when you're actually breathing in. And you kind of lose that connection. You lose that acuity of what's happening. So it can feel like you're looking through a fog. You know, in some of the Seattle mornings, they're filled with fog and trying to see through to see what is beyond. Another analogy of this hindrance is a bowl of water that when it's completely clear, we can see a reflection with a lot of clarity. When this hindrance is present, that bowl of water is filled with algae. It's very hard to see through clearly. It has all this obstruction in it. So hindrances also have this quality of obscuring what's being seen. It can have a quality of just heaviness, a sense of the body is not very lively. Sometimes spaciness. You're just kind of a little spaced out, not quite sure what's going on. And it also has this quality of, if you look closely, of avoidance, of a sense of kind of checking out from what's present. Rather check out than actually see or feel what's here, what's going on, a form of escape. I remember once I started to hear about this hindrance of sleepiness, I recalled when I was in high school and being a competitive swimmer and always feeling really nervous before our swim meets. And so my go-to escape would be to take a nap so I could just, you know, fall asleep really easily because I'd rather not feel the nervousness, not feel the nerves of that anticipation of whatever I thought the meet represented. And that sense of closing down, this way that we go into an escape. Even today, if I'm trying to write a talk and it's not quite coming out quickly enough and I just find myself getting sleepy and rather not be doing that activity. So this other quality of avoidance, of checking out. The sleepiness can have this sloth and torpor can sometimes feel like this almost force that's moving through our system, this wave of fatigue, of dullness. And even this last meditation, noticing that quality of focusing on the breath, focusing on the body, but also just feeling this little bit of a fog, a little bit of a obscuration between my observation and what's being seen. Right? So it can be very pervasive, very subtle. Now the opposite of sloth and torpor, let's explore that for a moment. So that's an acuity of seeing, that acuity of sight. There's this clarity of seeing. We see our breath in a sharp focus. There's a sense of being able to see the subtlety of the breath, seeing it in a very refined way. Remember when I had a cataract removed on this eye, and when I first had that lens replaced, it suddenly I could see everything in three-dimensional that I hadn't seen for years. And there's a sense of clarity of vision that was very striking when that cataract was replaced with a different lens. And so when sloth and torpor isn't present, there's this deep ability to see with a lot of clarity. There's also this element of sensitivity, that we can easily feel these nuances of this experience, this breath, you know, feeling the sense of reactivity to the breath, all being held in this very spacious quality. There's also this richness with that. It's very vivid when our attention is free of this hindrance. There's also a calmness. There's a natural way of being present and being accessible to what's here. So it feels like a natural state of attending. So some of these descriptions also point toward the quality of concentration, of samadhi, that sense of sustained attention, continuous attention, that our attention is able to rest and not waver so much. Right? So sloth and torpor tend to interrupt that stability, that steadiness. And finally, the opposite of sloth and torpor has this quality of interest, of curiosity, of investigation. And so instead of that sense of dullness, that sense of not quite sure where things are, there's this kind of burning interest, this burning impulse to see, because we want to relieve our suffering. We want to find some insight into the nature of freedom. And when that is arising in us, then that there's an absence of this hindrance of sloth and torpor. So one of the important things to realize with sloth and torpor and really any of the hindrances is that we often have to kind of burn through them, burn through a level of them. So like we have this almost like a residue around our bodies and around our minds and our hearts. We start to practice, and those just start to present themselves. Sometimes they come up in subtle ways, sometimes in big chunks and big waves. And if we can keep persevering in the midst of that, we start to actually burn through that. It starts to release, it starts to open up. It's not a linear process, because we might feel like we burn through something and feel a level of clarity, and then a deeper level of hindrance arises after that, and so on and so on. The key thing with the hindrance of sloth and torpor is not to struggle with it. Not to struggle with it. Because the more we struggle with it, the more we give ourselves that multiple hindrance attack. And you reflect on those times when you really not want to be sleepy during a meditation. You know, there's that aversion that's arising with the sleepiness. Now, in my own, I was reflecting on my own practice history around this hindrance of sleepiness and reflecting on how I worked with it at different stages, if you will. So at the very beginning, before I even knew what hindrances were, I just struggled with the fact I was sleepy. You know, I'm trying to meditate, I'm trying to do what I'm supposed to do, and why am I falling asleep? Why that sense of dullness? So without that recognition of the hindrance, I thought, okay, there's something wrong with me as the meditator. There's something wrong with my skill or the way I'm doing it, or maybe the technique. This is the hindrance of doubt coming in. So all that was arising, and I struggled quite a bit with that quality of sleepiness because I wanted to be upright. So there's a sense of struggling with that hindrance arising. Then after I became a little bit more aware of this as being a hindrance, I thought, okay, how do I work with it? What's there some of the skillful means? So when sleepiness would arise, I would just start throwing skillful means at it to try to make it go away. Right? So it'd be a sense of still being adverse to it, still struggling with it, and trying to overcome that through, you know, what we call skillful means. But still intact was this element of struggle, this element that this should not be here right now. If I was a good meditator, if I was a good, even deeper, a good person, I wouldn't be feeling sleepy. So I was trying to overcome this hindrance, but really trying to overcome this self, you know, the self-dislike that was kind of embedded in that early practice period. So some of the classic ways we work with sleepiness is to open our eyes, to actually have our eyes open during practice. Some traditions in Buddhist practices have your eyes open, like with Zen in particular, all the time. We typically suggest having the eyes closed. But if sleepiness is arising, you can open your eyes and just gaze about 3 feet in front of you in a soft, unfocused way. That arouses more energy. It's harder to drift away, drift into sleep. Checking the posture is another way to work with it, sitting more upright. One Zen story, a monk was working with this hindrance of sleepiness. He was becoming very frustrated with it. So he climbed up on the top of a building, on top of the ridge pole, and was meditating there, you know, because he figured, well, I'm not going to fall asleep here. But then he woke up in the morning, stretched out, perfectly balanced on the ridge pole. So opening the eyes, I often like to do something with my hands to bring a little bit more energy. One of my favorite ones is to make a couple interlacing loops and not letting them touch. Okay, so if I start to fall asleep, there's that touch that gives me a little bit of feedback. It's a little like the bumpers on the side of a car of a road when you drift off your lane. One of the best ways to work with sleepiness is to stand up. And I think this is something that we often kind of feel embarrassed about doing and don't want to make a big scene. You know, but standing up in the middle of a meditation is a very skillful way to work with it. You know, it really, just the effort of getting up, what are people going to think about me, brings a lot more energy to the system. And standing up, it's harder to fall asleep. It really works well. remember Christina Feldman, I was assisting her years ago, and she said whenever she sees someone stand up in the hall, she feels like applauding, because they're taking this stand to be upright, to work with sleepiness. And some other ways are pulling on the ears to bring more energy. Sometimes going for a brisk walk, bringing more energy that way. And also, sometimes taking a strategic nap can be very helpful. So kind of in this stage of my practice, I was really trying to throw these different strategies at sleepiness. But again, intact was this struggle with it. And then as my practice matured, there's a sense of actually turning toward sleepiness, turning toward it as an object of attention. And you can do that with all these hindrances, the hindrance of craving. You can turn toward it. What does this actually feel like? What's the mind state? What's the shape of the mind, the forms around craving? Same thing with aversion, with restlessness and worry and sleepiness. That's why it's in the four foundations of mindfulness. It's like, be mindful of the hindrance that arises. It's in the Satipatthana Sutta. Because when we're attending to it, when we're observing it, we're no longer lost in it. Seems like an obvious statement, but it's actually very profound. When we're caught in the middle of an experience, there's no space. There's no sense of perspective. We're just caught in a cycle of reactivity. But if there's a sense of being able to observe it, even a little bit, even a little bit of a hair space difference between the experience and our observation, then there's a potential for being mindful, for being present. And it allows us to shift from being reactive to it to being able to be responsive to it. It's a very critical shift. Last night I was teaching the first series of the beginning class. And as often happens, people would talk about their experience in that early first meditative period and feel like, okay, my mind keeps getting lost in thought. And I would point out that they noticing that they get lost is very different than being lost. Just observing, realizing, oh, my mind keeps getting shifted into thinking, it in itself is showing that stepping back, that sense of perspective that's arising. So I hope that this focus on the hindrances allow you to step back a little bit. As you step back, you're no longer struggling in the same way. So at this stage of my practice, I started to turn toward hindrance of sleepiness with a quality of curiosity, with a quality of interest. Like, what does this sleepiness, this sloth and torpor actually feel like? Before that, I was just trying to get rid of it. I was trying to overcome it, throwing those skillful means at it, like trying to throw some kind of antidote at something. But that sense of curiosity, it became very interesting to watch that sense of being awake, being alert, and that sense of like almost like a cloud going over the sun, and that darkness that arises, that quality of heaviness, you know, feeling the inclination of the body to close over. So by doing this, the sleepiness started to lose some of its grip and becoming actually aware of it without being so laced with aversion. You know, it's really hard to actually be curious and be averse at the same time. It's really hard to listen to somebody when you already have a judgment about which they should be doing, how they should be acting. But for people to drop that and actually listen, then, you know, wondrous, you actually learn something, you actually see something. So learning to drop that quality of aversion, of dislike, of self-judgment, to actually see. And when you start to work with it in this way, again, we're not being so reactive, we're not caught in the psycho-reactivity, suddenly all of this options of how to work with it arise. You start to have more potential choices that reveal themselves. And one of the best ways is when sleepiness is arising, is to start to notice the mode of meditation that I'm using, the style of meditation. So often we do have this kind of repertoire of practice. Sometimes a really one-pointed focus, sometimes much more of a choiceless awareness when we're just being aware of whatever's arising in this moment. Sometimes like focusing on a particular element of our experience, sometimes an element of mind. And when sloth and torpor is predominant or present, choiceless awareness probably isn't the best choice. Because choiceless awareness requires this level of stability of attention, this level of perception, this sensitivity, and this kind of broadness of vision, really, of perception. When we get lost in sleepiness, that's the opposite of where our mind is. It can very easily go into actually falling asleep, drifting into thought. At the same time, one-pointed focus sometimes isn't quite right either. It's generally a better bet, unless we're bringing a lot of striving to that, a lot of tension to our one-pointed focus. I have to just keep coming back to my breath, nothing else. That kind of efforting, that over-efforting, tends to create more of sloth and torpor. We tend to get more exhausted from that kind of a practice. It's almost like there's a backlash that comes from that overexertion, that overstriving. So it's helpful to, when you find one of the hindrances present, to just check what is your attitude. Utejaniya has this lovely sheet of, you know, the right attitude in meditation. It's not one of the Eightfold Path, but it's a lovely way of noticing, how am I out of balance in my meditation? You know, am I overworking it? Am I over-efforting it? Do I have some agenda that I'm trying to achieve? I'm trying to get to a certain place. And when you feel that, try to find this place of balance, of simply meeting what actually is, instead of what you think should be here. And that includes this sense of you, how you should be. Okay, if we step back and say, okay, what's my attitude here? What's my striving? Okay, I'm really trying to get to this one place. Then step back a little further and say, okay, where's the sense of me? How does that look? How does that shape actually feel like? And that sense of me-ness that's trying to get somewhere, that sense of me who is perhaps inadequate, insufficient, that will finally become sufficient by achieving whatever that might be. Remember what I talked about, when you observe it, you're no longer so lost in it. So that shift of just asking that question, how am I showing up? How am I formed in this place? How's the sense of Tim in this moment? The quality of meeting what is. Now, many of us do have this overdeveloped striving, this overdeveloped sense of perfectionism, trying to be the good meditator. And so then, you know, learning how to back off that, learning how to relax that is so essential. That was one of my main learnings early on, was to how not to be so caught in my diligence, to a point where it became a hindrance. Not to be so effortful at the expense of being balanced. So much of what I learned early on, you know, through my mid part of my practice, was how to be softer, how to be more receptive, not to have that sense of striving, that sense of having to do. So maybe setting an intention to practice a certain length of time and feeling the fatigue and just that amount of life kind of going over, you know, the lack of sleep, the lack of a rest, and trying to power through that was not so helpful. On the other hand, sometimes we have to know our natural tendency, because sometimes we like to kind of relax into that sense of sleepiness, because it's kind of pleasant, you know. I just kind of hang out with this daydream a little bit longer. Well, no one's going to really know, will they? And it's such a nice one. Yeah, and we just kind of find that little bit of leaning into that that sense of wanting to kind of indulge in that. Especially if that becomes a habit, or if we're falling asleep regularly in the meditation, we need to bring more effort, more energy to our practice, more diligence, more willingness to stand up, to work with that edge of effort. Starting to really kindle that fire, that passion for practice. You know, why are we practicing? What are we trying to see? This is so essential because sleepiness, sloth, and torpor is really this wave of, maybe not a wave, it's more of a force field of delusion that we have to have enough energy to see through, to start to dissipate. And maybe another analogy is in a foggy day in Seattle, you can't see anything, and it needs the power of the sun to start to dissipate that fog. If you don't have that internal sunlight, then the fog remains. And there's a tremendous amount of fog, a tremendous amount of delusion that we have to learn to see through. Also, as my practice continued to mature, there's a sense of meeting sleepiness, sloth, and torpor with a quality of compassion and wisdom and discernment. You know, what is really here? What is really present with this state? You know, what are the factors? You know, if I'm not sleeping enough, of course I'm going to be sleepy. I remember when my daughter was a newborn, I read that the average parent loses 700 hours the first years of their child's life. So of course there's a tremendous amount of deficit that you bring to when you try to practice. It's really hard to always be alert. If we're going through a very stressful time, if we're dealing with a lot of grief, often sloth and torpor manifests more and more. So just noticing that and having some compassion for yourself. Maybe there's a time for replenishment that's more needed instead of that self-denial, that self-strictness, being strict. Wisdom and compassion also has this simple question of asking, am I avoiding, am I denying something that's present? Am I trying to cover up something that's already here? So often we feel that sleepiness, even though we may be getting lots of rest. And then it's really helpful to ask this question I learned from Sharon Salzberg. What would I be feeling if I wasn't sleepy? So what would I be feeling if I wasn't sleepy? And sometimes there's a sense of grief, a sense of anger, a sense of aversion, craving that I'm not fully acknowledging. I've put sleepiness over to kind of dampen things down, to kind of chill things out. And then there's the part of the discernment is noticing, okay, is this helpful right now? Because sometimes it is helpful to do a wise avoidance, to not feel something because our capacity isn't up to it. And then the final thing to mention is with sloth and torpor, what we eat does matter. You know, it's very predictable after in a retreat. The first sitting after lunch, there's going to be a lot more sleepiness. I mean, how many of you have noticed that? You know, so how much do we eat during lunch? What kinds of foods all help lead to more clarity of mind or more sloth and torpor? So this is kind of the bottom line of what I've talked about so far is learning how to see sloth and torpor not as something to struggle with, but as something to understand, to bring a quality of interest, of really the essence of mindfulness to it. So we're not being adverse to the sloth and torpor. By doing so, we can see what's the right antidote. You know, maybe I need to try to get more than 6 hours of sleep a night. You know, maybe I need to work with my grief in a more direct way. You know, maybe I need to sit up a little straighter and bring a little more energy that way. There's a whole host of ways of working with sloth and torpor. And then one of the deeper ways to understand it, and I'm just going to touch upon this tonight, and we'll bring that out more in the next talk on this topic, is that how sloth and torpor is this expression of delusion. Now, delusion, there's these three kleshas, these three main unwholesome roots. So I know, you know, don't get too worked up around the word unwholesome, or sometimes called evil roots. But these are kind of the core things that create our suffering. So hatred and greed are essential ones. We see with the hindrance of aversion, we've got hatred coming up. With craving, we have greed coming up. But underlying both of those is delusion. And delusion we can see as simply not understanding how things actually are. This basic confusion, particularly around the sense of self. So delusion, when that's present, then greed and hatred make more sense. It really depends upon not seeing things clearly. Now delusion has this level of, like this force field that we all have to learn to penetrate through, to see through. And it has that level of a fog that becomes very obscuring. And through practice, just that sense of diligence, of not being turned away by the fogginess, the dullness, to actually still stay on track, to still try to find that breath that starts to burn that away. Delusion is hard because it does have this level of obscuring, of unclarity. It's harder to see. With aversion, with craving, as those manifestation, we have the action that becomes more obvious. We find the impulse to reach for something that we want, the impulse to push away something we don't want. Maybe we catch ourselves in the middle of eating a whole box of candy or something, say, oh wow, maybe I'm caught here in my craving, right? So you can see that quality of greed that arises. Delusion doesn't have such a clear marker that we can catch, that we can see so easily. That's why we have to really be diligent with how we meet sleepiness, sloth, and torpor. It's that willingness to not get lost in it, again, not to struggle with it, but to really meet that. And understand that when you're meeting it in this way, you're directly starting to meet delusion. And as the delusion starts to fade and starts to have more space around it, then there's this clarity. And in that clarity, there's the direct seeing. And in that direct seeing is when the insights arise. And from the insights arising is the power of liberation. All right, let's just sit quietly for a moment or two and let those words fade. Thank you for your attention. I just want to say a few words about the homework or practice and reflection. Someone once asked us to not use the word homework because it's a little too reminiscent of being in school, I guess. Which is a good suggestion. So this week, make observation of sloth and torpor a special focus. So bring it into, you can be mindful of your breath, you can be mindful of your body, you can be mindful of your mind state, including sloth and torpor. Just start to notice, okay, I want to see if this is present. And you may be surprised of how present it really is. You know, how does this manifest during your meditation? You know, both the overt quality that you just, your head's nodding, to more that subtle quality of dullness, of fogginess, of lack of clarity, of acuity. And then noticing how do you relate to sloth and torpor? Through aversion, through disliking, or through curiosity, through interest. So you can make your very relationship another object of attention. When you start to get the knack of this, suddenly all the doors open for you. Anything that arises in your life becomes an invitation to practice, to engage. But when there's a quality of not seeing this relationship, like, okay, I'm averse to my craving or to my sleepiness, then I'm just struggling with sleepiness. As soon as I notice that I don't like the fact that I'm sleepy, I'm no longer lost in it. I've stepped back to observe with objectivity. And then you can use discernment. Can you bring a quality of discernment to see how can I work with this best in this moment? There's not a one-size-fits-all approach to sloth and torpor. There's so many different manifestations of it. So you have to really ride that horse, or you want to say ride that, to keep driving that car, you have to meet that. You can't just go on autopilot. And then finally, for extra credit, do the same thing to your daily life. See how sloth and torpor arise in your life. Because please understand, the hindrances aren't just a meditator's problem. It's a human condition. It's a human way of relating to life. And so it can be very interesting to notice, what times do you tend to check out and be more sleepy? What times do you tend to be more alert and awake? And then how do I work with that? All right, so let's open up to any comments or questions about sloth and torpor or anything else. Yes, Krista.
I find it really helpful to sense the self forming more solidly than listening. And that's fairly easy to do if I'm paying attention with greed or aversion. So Rani's book, he says, vagueness is a form of self-referencing, but I think it's what you're saying about the illusion. It's hard. Is it the fog that's a self-referencing? Can you
get a few more clues? Sure. So the question is around noticing how aversion has this selfing that's really easy to see, that formation of self, and also the dissipation of that. You know, that seems to be more obvious. But the quality of you said vagueness or diffusion or
vagueness.
Yeah, so you can say vagueness is a form of sloth and torpor, kind of the way I'm using it tonight.
And you think it's a form of self.
Also a form of self. Yes, self creation. Yeah, so that quality of vagueness. I'm not going to say what Rodney meant by that, because you have to ask directly that. But from my, you know, hearing that phrase, hearing that question, the sense of vagueness is almost more of a, let's see how to say it. I don't know why this analogy comes to mind, but I'll use it. Do you ever see the movie The Forbidden Planet? So it's set in space, and these space guys go to this planet, and there's this kind of hermit living there. And, you know, they interact with him, and then people start getting killed, and they're wondering what's going on. And there's this sense of the id, really, the sense of this person's manifesting out. Hopefully not spoiling the movie for people. But anyway, he's kind of has this big monster that his subconscious comes out. And when he's really angry, it's really strong, it's really clearly defined. But when he's not so caught in that sense of anger, a sense of fear, it's much more, you know, amorphous. But it's still very much there. So it's like that, it's more, what was I going to say, it's like this more basic level of the conceit of self, the delusion of self, the assumption of self, that's just kind of the background, you know, there's me here somewhere, but I can't really find it. But that's, I still believe in that sense of meanness. So it can feel very vague. It's like, well, I kind of am here, but I'm not quite sure why that is. Well, when I'm angry, it's all really consolidated. Or if I'm really craving something, it's really consolidated. It's very clear. But it's coming from that basic root that we've kind of taken a bunch of, I'm throwing a bunch of analogies out there for you. It's like when you have a snowstorm and the snow is very not very packable. You can't make snow people out of it so well. You put it together, it falls apart. It's still snow. It's still that sense of meanness. But when I'm angry or triggered, I can pack it together, you know, because it's more that way. But it's still, the essence is there. It's harder to get a clear sense of that because it's asking you to look at a much more fundamental level of delusion, much more fundamental perspective of self. Because when the self falls away, there's a level of clarity that's very crisp. There's very, you know, there's a sense of it's not this kind of vagueness. It's this very shift of perspective that's there. Does that help?
It does. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes, Jerry.
Well, I just was going to add something that I was feeling to your question, and that's that so sleepiness is kind of a form of a defense of collapse. So, you know, you can either become a really big, outgoing, controlling person, or you can collapse, and it's a,
yes,
it's a defense mechanism against pain and suffering, right? So it's like you become a non-person, which is an identity, right? That's what happens to me when I go into sleepy mode, which was one of my chronic defenses. You know, if things are too much, I just sleep a lot, right? So then I just don't have to exist, which is part of my identity, right? I'm
yes,
not quite good enough to handle all this.
Yes, yeah, I think... just to kind of recap that for the recording, the sleepiness often can be this sense of not wanting to feel, not wanting to deal with this experience, kind of as a way of checking out. And I think you're right that the pain of having that fear or that sadness arise, it's a painful sense of self. And it's less painful to be more amorphous, less defined. You know, so it's still in relationship to something. And that sense of being in relationship to something, of going towards something, going away from it, you know, being the same as, being different than, all that is a more fundamental way of the sense of self manifesting itself. And so as that starts to fall away, then there's no longer a need to be closer to or further away from, because you automatically have this perception of being very close to. There doesn't make sense to distance. And so, you know, the delusion of, in terms of sleepiness and sloth and torpor, it does have that quality of arising there. Does that make sense? I'm a little tired myself today. And, you know, again, sleepiness, and sometimes it's a factor of not getting enough sleep and being overworked. So it's not always have to do with delusion. Sometimes it's just, you know, we're overworking ourselves. Remember, I think Ellen was sharing in the beginning class, her and Rodney would teach that for many years. And he would always give this assignment to get 8 hours of sleep. Okay? And then one younger man came up at the end of the series and said, "This course has just transformed my life." And they're thinking, "Oh, wow, you know, the Dharma's really been..." He says, "I've actually got 8 hours of sleep for the first time in my life. And I feel great." So, yeah, I know it's sleepiness. It's hard when life has so many demands. I don't feel like I've had a regular good night's sleep since my daughter was born 15 years ago. Because it's just something gets off there, and of course there's lots of demands, and yeah, so you know I have a lot of compassion for that. I don't usually tell people they have to get 8 hours of sleep because I know sometimes it's hard. But if you do have the choice, get more sleep. All right. Any other questions or comments?
Because it is the wobbliest.
Yes, yeah, the delusion, yes, you know, sloth and torpor, it is, you know, it's easy just to write it off as something you just throw skillful means at. You know, you try to overcome it and eventually it will pass, which it will. But if we start to look at our relationship to it and start to notice it as delusion, it can be very helpful to actually see, okay, there's this sense of delusion, this sense of fogginess, a sense of vagueness, you know, that's arising here. And, you know, can I keep my course? I think that's where our grit as meditators starts to come forth, is can we meditate in the midst of being lost in sleepiness, lost in sloth and torpor? You know, it's easy to find your way to the top of the mountain when it's clear, but when it's foggy and stormy, it's much harder to do that. So having that sense of perseverance, it will pay off. And sometimes this happens in our lives that, you know, if you've ever traveled someplace and you come back to where you live, there's a sense of freshness. You start to see familiar things in a more fresh, new way, because you've been immersed in a different culture, a different environment, different things going on. And so suddenly you see life in a much more crisp way. That's a level of delusion that has lifted off, a level of not seeing. Often people report after a retreat that the world seems much more rich. There's a much more of a sense of clarity, a sense of vividness. And what's happened is there's a level of delusion that has you've burnt through, that you've lifted off of. You may even notice that in the course of a single sitting, that at the end there's a sense of liveliness that is present, even though that might have been filled with sleepiness, sloth and torpor. There's acuity that has come. So just to trust that the practice is working, even though you may feel sleepy. I think I really start to notice this when I started to teach retreats and be able to meet with a student early on in the retreat and later on in the retreat. Because early on, they'd be often be complaining about some of the hindrances. And then later on, there would often be this deepening, this opening. And so in the midst of a hindrance, there's a tremendous amount of discouragement, that there's something wrong with me, there's something wrong with the practice. But in reality, it's this process of it burning off. And as that hindrance arises, it's not very comfortable, it's not very fun. But if we're able to stay our course, it eventually shifts and something deeper arises. The paradox is that then that something, another deeper level of hindrance arises after a while. And so it's kind of this process of back and forth. Yes? Oh, good.
It's kind of cute, the words.
Yeah, they are kind of cute.
There's something, you know, like, for me. But my experience is, and I don't know if I'm using the correct word, is it's almost endogenous. It's so physical. Mm. That is, some days I'll wake up and I'll feel my whole body will feel like that.
Yes.
And you said inertia and initiative. And so I think there's something else going on with sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor seems so pejorative compared to sleepiness, which is a natural process. So the delusional aspect, I understand, you know, there's a little bit of what you're saying.
Sure. Yes, I do, yeah. I think so. So let me see if I can rephrase it and see if I got it. So on one hand, there's the delusional quality of it, but there's also this sense of sometimes you just wake up and there's this state of being that kind of just seems to permeate through the physical body, the mental body, and doesn't seem to be so much linked to Dharma, but more of this kind of state of being. Is there something else that's going on? Is that...
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So I wonder if one would look at it a little differently, or if that's part of a link with delusion. I'm just wondering.
Well, I think it's important to to not look at sloth and torpor as just the one manifestation, that there's sometimes there's very valid reasons that are more based in physiology, based in our health, based in our mental status, based on our age. I mean, there's all this, you know, newborns sleep a whole bunch. They're not lost in sloth and torpor. You know, kids sleep 12 hours. You know, it's like that's what they need, you know. And as we get older, I mean, it's, as a teacher, it's certainly, there's a subset of students who tend to fall asleep more, and they tend to be more retirement age. But there's a natural way that we tend to need to sleep more as we get older also. And whether that's the physiology of that. So not to base everything on that this is just delusion coming through my system. Sometimes it's just the natural state of the body. So, you know, sloth and torpor, you know, or sleepiness is based on conditions. You know, there's conditions that can be how much, what we're eating, you know, how much we're exercising, our health, all these different qualities come up with that. And there's also this quality of delusion. And so that's where that discernment is so helpful. To say, okay, what is this sloth and torpor? Is this me, you know, not feeling something? Is this me avoiding something? Is this me not having my energy for my practice? Or is it just, you know, I'm just tired, or maybe...
How about circadian rhythms?
Yeah, it could be, yeah.
When you said after we eat, a lot of us fall asleep when we're out. Mm-hmm. We have trouble. Well, maybe the problem isn't so much that we're falling asleep, the problem is that someone scheduled us to meditate after lunch. and, no, I'm serious. Like,
yeah.
It does sound funny, but...
I
mean,
yeah, so
the... My mind is a little funny.
Yeah. Yes.
Is that the body needs to rest in almost every culture in the world does that. And I wonder if it's just the opposite part. Some of what we may be seeing as, you know, I'm speaking from the top of venom, is that we're imposing cultural requirements or structural requirements on bodies that are in circadian rhythms.
Yes. So
natural kinds of rhythms that we are...
Sure. Yeah, so the comment was around just natural circadian rhythms, and maybe that's just a natural time that we're more sleepy, and we're trying to fight that by making people meditate in opposite of those rhythms. And yeah, and that may be true, and kind of inherent in the question, though, is that the sense of struggle with the fact that you're sleepy. Why can't you meditate when you're sleepy? Why can't you have that sense of sloth and torpor? Okay, that's how it is. It's like if I only went out into the Seattle when it was sunny out, I wouldn't go out very much. But if I can go out when it's cloudy and foggy and snowy and rainy, then I have a lot of capacity to enjoy the environment. If I only meditate when I'm alert, I have a very limited level of capacity. I want to be able to meet whatever life shows at me. You know, it's not, I don't want to just do it when it's perfect. I want to be able to meditate when I'm falling asleep, when I'm completely alert. And I want to have that capacity to bring this mindfulness. So that's really where, that's another reason to work, even though when we're sleepy, is resting on that sense of meeting this moment's experience, no matter what it is. Yes?
I just wanted to sort of, because that my question was going to be, you know, because I like to meditate when I'm tired.
Yes.
Because if my mind is quieter, I'm not so chattery.
Mm. Yes.
But if I'm tired and I'm aware that I'm just tired, and I take and I sit down to meditate, sometimes I just have a better chance to feel what's going on with me. Or, you know, I'm not spending my whole meditation just trying to get my mind to stop chattering.
Yes, nice. So I actually haven't thought of it, but that's a good way of working with it. Is I'm actually using the natural pattern of being more sleepy, more quiet, as also your mind is more quiet. So you can actually be more tranquil as you're meditating. And that's a great way to work with it. So to kind of go back to that question and the last question, I think in daily life, it's really helpful to find a time that works well for you. You know, because you're not meditating all day. You can find a period of time that you're not sleepy, if that works better, or a time that you are sleepy, if that works better. You know, so you can make the conditions as good as you can. And at the same time, stretching that capacity to meet things, you know, when they're not ideal. I think, you know, in beginning classes, I always say, find an ideal situation, but don't stay stuck there. Right? And we go on a retreat and we sit, start first sitting at 5:45, 6:15, and we last sittings at 9, you know, you get to see a whole bunch of different states of mind, different circadian rhythms. And there's a lot of confidence that comes from that. I meditate when I'm sleepy, I meditate when I'm tranquil, when I'm alert, when I'm agitated. I can meditate in all of those. That's one of the values of going on a retreat. You get to see yourself in a longer period. Stack a few days, you get to see that evolve and change. All right, anyone else? Did I see another hand, or are we? All right, so thank you for your engaged questions.